is People versus Walker, case number 2011, SC 289. Are both attorneys ready? Argument is set for an hour. Both of you are experienced appellate lawyers and know that the petitioner has to keep track of your time, and please tell us who you represent when you step to the podium. And what I said about the iPad goes. We're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, Your Honors, good morning. My name is Joseph Michaels, attorney registration number 40403. I'm here today on behalf of the people of the state of Colorado. I'd like to start addressing the jury trial waiver and then save my response for the indeterminate sentencing issue until after I hear from opposing counsel, if that's okay with this court. The waiver in this case was constitutionally effective for four reasons. First, a colloquy on par with the requirements set forth in CRIMP 23852 is not constitutionally required in order to effect a valid waiver. Second, the waiver here substantially complied with the requirements in CRIMP 23852, and this court has repeatedly held that substantial waivers can constitutionally effect a valid waiver. Three, the record establishes that this was not a waiver done on a spur of the moment or on a whim, but that it was thought out and well-reasoned. And four, there was no plain error here, and certainly no plain error that undermined the fundamental fairness of the trial, such that it would undermine the reliability of the conviction. Turning to the plain error issue first in the standard review, the defendant and I both agree that there was no objection lodged at any point during the trial process, be it from the moment of the waiver itself all the way until trial and then through trial. In fact, it was not until the appeal itself that the first objection came about. However, what the defendant and I disagree is who bears the burden of establishing the error. And the defendant's position is that the defendant does not have to establish any error. This is essentially requiring this court to adopt a structural error standard, even though the defendant doesn't say so quite in so many words. As this court well knows, structural error is limited to a very narrow, very limited category of errors, and it's not addressed on a case-by-case issue, but rather it happens every time it arises and essentially renders any appellate review impossible. Structural errors have been usually confined to a biased trial court judge, the failure of jury instructions to convey that the jury must be convicted beyond a reasonable doubt, or jury instructions that that provide that elements are already proven for the prosecution.
Mr. Michaels, sure. Before you get too far away from that, would you concede or do you believe that deprivation of a jury trial without a valid waiver would be structural error?
No, I do not. And the reason I don't is because the essence of structural error is that there's no way to assess any sort of problem. And here we have several ways to assess whether there are other bases to affirm, including whether there's a substantial compliance with the waiver, whether there are facts.
You're talking about whether the waiver is valid.
Sure.
But would you concede that if there is not a valid waiver, that deprivation of a jury trial would be structural error? If you were just not given a jury trial, is that not something that affects the very structure of the proceeding rather than a question of trial, admission of evidence, instructions, or anything else?
I don't think it would be structural error, and here's why. In the first place, in the case where there's a jury trial waiver at all, there's an indication that there's at least a desire to waive the jury trial right. And when you have a jury trial waiver and you're just taking it...
I don't think you understood Justice Coates' question. His question is, let's assume that you just went up to trial and the judge never gave you a jury, period. There was no opportunity, nothing.
If you never have
the opportunity, that structural error.
That would be a different question. If you never have the opportunity whatsoever to even address the issue, then that very well might be structural error. But the difference is that you're still getting the exact same fact-finding function. You just don't have the jury. You have the same trial outcome. You have the same facts are being admitted. You just have a different fact finder.
And I guess where that sort of leads to the next step is, well, if a defendant is told he can't have a jury trial in violation of his constitutional right, but he doesn't make an objection to that, would we look at the trial as a whole and apply a plain error standard to decide whether he was actually deprived of his constitutional right or not, or what the remedy should be for that?
I think you would look at the trial as a whole, see what, I mean, you look at the sufficiency of the evidence, what other errors might have occurred.
So even in the most outrageous situation in which a defendant is deprived, he is not allowed to have a jury trial in a situation to which he would be constitutionally entitled to one. If there's enough evidence against him, if it's a strong enough case proved to the judge, you're saying we'd still apply a plain error standard and maybe find that there's no remedy for him.
I believe so, but that's obviously not the case here, where he was in fact given a jury trial waiver that went through some of the substantial steps of 23A52. And the United States Supreme Court has weighed in on an issue similar to this in United States versus Domingo Benitez. That there was in the context of a guilty plea, but it said that a defendant has to show that but for any error, again, in the waiver process, that he would have elected a trial by jury. In that case, obviously, to go to trial by jury, but the same rationale is applicable here.
Before you step away from that point about the application of plain error here because of the lack of an objection,
sure.
Thinking in the Curtis context, have we ever applied plain error where the claim on appeal is an invalid advisement? I mean, why are you saying that in this context where the nature of the claim is, I was inadequately advised, you're putting the burden on the defendant to raise an objection to that inadequacy contemporaneously? I'm struggling with that logic.
I think part of the problem here is that with Arguello and Curtis, they were established waiver requirements at that point. Here at the time of the defendant's trial, the waiver requirements were totally flipped on their head. So 5 weeks before his waiver, this court promulgated Crimp 23A5 and added subsection 2 that listed the little checklist of the extra things to ask. Up until that point, the only requirement in the state of Colorado was that it be a constitutionally valid, knowing, voluntary, and intelligent waiver. But the case law, all the prevailing case law up until that point had been that no on-record advisement had been required, that a written advisement would be okay, or just a basic affirmation. Some cases even said a defendant can get up there and just simply nod his head in agreement.
Right, and so the new rule amended all of that and in fact requires a trial court now to walk through four or five very specific, or be satisfied that the defendant understands four or five specific things. So are you saying just because it was new, the trial court didn't need to follow it, or?
I'm not saying the trial court didn't need to follow it, but I'm saying it was a seismic shift in the way that courts had to look at the waiver requirement. And up to that point, the courts simply had to ask questions of the defendant to make sure that it was a voluntary waiver, to make sure the defendant was not being coerced by his counsel. And in fact, one of the questions that the trial court here asked was, have you taken any drugs or medication or alcohol that would somehow render this invalid otherwise? That's a question that we see in terms of plea bargaining, guilty pleas, waiver of the right to testify.
Given that it's, as you described it, a seismic shift in the nature of the advisement, that suggests to me that under that circumstance, there's even less reason to require the defendant to be saying, wait, you're not telling me everything I'm supposed to be hearing and understanding. Peg him on a plain error standard of review on appeal for having failed to contemporaneously object to that inadequate advisement.
I'm not sure the advisement is inadequate because the 23A52 simply codified isn't quite the right word I'm looking for, but it set down certain requirements to ask. And I don't think anybody was prepared necessarily to look at those and understand that all of a sudden we have this massive difference from how we used to do business just 5 weeks beforehand. And so I think that's why you have the objection to alert the trial court, to alert the parties that there is this difference. There has to be more to the waiver requirement.
What's the practice now in the courts? I mean, through the new requirements, right? Go through those checkpoints.
I believe so, and part of that is come about through a few decisions from the Court of Appeals, this one included, that have made the court aware.
But I'm concerned we're taking this case in this transition time. I understand why the trial judge wasn't used to it, but you're asking for a general substantial compliance standard based on, to construe a rule where we came up with, after the rulemaking process, this checklist, which apparently is being utilized. But now we're going to have a lesser standard of holding trial courts to giving that, apparently, right?
Well, I'm not sure I'm asking for a lesser standard. I'm just making sure that the substantial compliance and not a strict compliance with every item of the checklist. And that's what this court has held forever in most every waiver case, from People versus Arguello to People versus Curtis to People versus Blem. People versus Arguello explicitly says that you don't have to hit every item in this checklist, and there's that checklist appendicized to the Arguello opinion. You don't have to hit everything as long as it substantially complies.
So how is substantial compliance met here? Let's assume that substantial compliance is a standard that needs to be met, not strict, but substantial. How is that, in fact, met by this colloquy, given the seismic shift you've identified in
sure.
presented by the new rule?
It's meant in a couple ways. Now, I think what we want to do is, first of all, look at what was there and what was not there. And the first item that wasn't there is the trial court's supposed to say, are you aware that your waiver applies to any items that would have to be found by a jury? He didn't ask him that specifically. That's also something that would have appeared in the initial advisement, the initial appearance, when the trial court is advising him against the charges against him. The next thing that...
Are you pointing us somewhere in the record where that advisement was in fact given at an earlier juncture?
This is one of the last records that is not on CD. I haven't been able to see the initial advisement since I turned in a brief months ago at this point. So I would have to beg your forgiveness and ask you to look at the initial advisement yourself. But that's also another reason that if in fact you find this waiver insufficient, that a remand would be the proper remedy in order to have that fact-finding determination of what was said at the initial advisement, what the attorney told the defendant at the same time. But back to the advisement that was specifically given here. The next...
Wait, Mr. Michael, I just don't quite get that. What initial advisement are you talking about?
When the defendant, the first appearance, the initial appearance.
Initial appearance in county court? That he tells you have a right to a lawyer and set bond and that sort of thing?
You have the right to an attorney. These are the charges against you.
And at that point, you say that we should look at to find a proper...
I think it's possible. I simply don't recall. But that's certainly one of the reasons to discuss at a post-conviction remedy, post-conviction hearing. The other issues in the jury trial waiver that weren't addressed were that the defendant would be entitled to a jury of 12 and a unanimous decision from them. That's something else that would have gone on the initial appearance. It's also something that the defendant would have talked with his lawyer about. And I submit that it's something that most people, especially a middle school teacher, would be familiar with at that point in their life. There's no indication this defendant was an uneducated man, quite the contrary, that he was quite educated, enough to be teaching our, I think it was eighth grade, the children.
Do you seem to be conceding, though, with that example, that whether the advisement was complied with in its entirety, right at this point in time when he waived, you seem to be saying, in order to make an effective waiver, though, of his right to jury trial, he would have to know that he was entitled to a 12-person jury. Do you think that's true?
No, I don't think that's true. I think it's one aspect that might inform the validity of the waiver, but there are other aspects outside of this, the text of this rule, that would also inform the validity of a waiver, such as whether he was on drugs, whether he had alcohol in the system, whether he knew what was going on, whether he talked with his attorney about it. And the record here, under both the former and the current version of CRIMP 23A, the prosecutor was required to consent one way or another. And the record here shows that the prosecution immediately consented, but in order for a prosecutor to consent, they're going to have to talk with the victims, they're going to have to talk with their supervisor. There's no indication that the prosecutor or the defendant or the trial court, indeed, were at all shocked by this idea of waiving the right to a jury trial.
Maybe you then could explain how you see these specific new requirements in Rule 23, how they relate to the constitutional requirement that a waiver be knowing, voluntary, and intelligent. Because the colloquy around are you on drugs and so forth, that suggests to me whether this in fact is voluntary, but perhaps the specific requirements that you understand you're entitled to a jury of 12, that the jury has to render a unanimous verdict, that jury can find facts related to sentencing, would that not maybe go to the intelligent prong of that constitutional requirement?
I agree that the specific colloquy talks specifically about the intentional, the intelligent prong of it. I think knowing if someone's on drugs or otherwise involuntary also talks about to that intentional prong. But one of the things that we're talking about with CRIMP 23A is that it's not a constitutional prerequisite. It's more of an insurance policy. It's there not to enforce a enforce a new constitutional right, but it's there to ensure a validity, to make it crystal clear on appeal that we've gone through this, we don't have any question about it. It doesn't necessarily mean that its absence, the colloquy itself is not a prerequisite to validity, in other words. It's a way of ensuring validity, but it's not the end-all be-all of a constitutional, constitutionally valid jury trial waiver.
And could I interrupt you right there? I appreciate what you're saying there, and it seems to me the analogy is very much to Rule 11. You're saying this rule, we set out these things in order to evidence an effective plea or effective waiver of a constitutional
Absolutely.
Right, but we didn't intend these to be a separate requirement in and of themselves. How do we know that?
Besides the fact that you wrote the rule, and I can't presume to get inside your heads, I think a lot of this rule was based on the Tenth Circuit's case in United States versus Robertson. And Robertson identifies quite a few of these similar prongs that are discussed in 23A5-2. But then Robertson goes on and says, these are not the sole requirements, and just going through this little checklist is not going to necessarily ensure a waiver, neither is failing to go through it going to ensure the waiver. Rather, you're going to have to look at the facts of the case surrounding the waiver itself. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, well, I take it the thrust of that answer is we copied from the feds, and the feds didn't intend to create separate requirements but only evidencing an effective plea, and therefore we must have intended the same thing. Is that sort of the thrust of the argument?
I'll agree with the feds part. I'm not going to comment on whether you copied them or not. But otherwise, I think and the federal courts are very clear, almost unanimously so, that substantial compliance is adequate. I'm not sure any of the circuits require strict compliance. As far as I can tell, the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, 9th, 10th, 11th, and D.C. circuits all require just substantial compliance. And like CRIMP 11, they only require that a certain and the CRIMP 23A5-2 here only requires that a certain determination is made, and that determination is that the waiver is valid, and here's a way to
do it. But there had been some movement in the U.S. Supreme Court law and ours too, and that is those issues that need to be found by a jury, right? Need to be found by a jury, as opposed to the judge.
Are you referring to Apprendi and Blakely?
Of course. This is all post-Apprendi and Blakely, is it not?
Sure. And a lot of these district court decisions have all been a post-Apprendi and Blakely. They're saying that you have to ensure that the defendant understands that the judge will be the sole fact finder. And that's what we have here. We have the defendant specifically moving the judge in order to be the fact finder. The defendant took advantage of the fact that I've got 50 counts of sexual misconduct facing me against three different children as a middle school teacher. I would like you, Your Honor, to be the fact finder here, which means that he was aware that the judge was going to be the sole fact finder, even if the judge didn't explicitly say, you are aware of this, and the defendant didn't say, yes, I'm aware of this. The defendant thrice reaffirmed that he wanted to waive his jury trial right and wasn't being coerced to do so. With that, I'd like to save the remainder of my time for rebuttal and response to my opposing counsel argument.
You may.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Elizabeth Griffin, here on behalf of Marshall Walker. I presume that I won't get rebuttal, is that correct?
That is unless he goes over his time.
Okay. Yes. Then I guess I'll start with the jury trial waiver. I think we agree that the waiver of the right to jury trial must be knowing, intelligent, and voluntary in order to be valid. So that's the first point of agreement. And that's because the jury trial is a fundamental right Apprendi told us that it's a right of surpassing importance. In Colorado, it's a paramount right, and it's a right that is inviolate and a matter of substantive due process under our Constitution. I assume we agree that in order to make a knowing, involuntary, and intelligent waiver, a person has to understand the consequences of what they're doing. And in this case, that means you need to understand the consequences of giving up a jury, which would be 12 people that the prosecution has to convince to unanimously agree on your guilt, and instead go before one judge, and also that any facts going to any sentence enhancer, that you would be waiving your right to jury trial on that as well. And also that it's your own personal decision, and even if your attorney perhaps doesn't relish the fact of selecting a jury and conducting a sexual assault in trial in front of a jury, that it's your right to have that jury if you want to.
Ms. Griffin, you may have to help me out here, but I'm not aware, and I understand obviously the argument that it's a fundamental right, but I don't think we've ever said that it has to be your personal decision like we said in Curtis. Am I wrong about that?
Yeah, you are, actually, okay. Because in the Rice case, that was a 1977 case. It's in my brief. And that was, I think, most of what Rice talked about. But I'm glad that we're talking about Rice, because in Rice, in 1977, this court also said that the waiver must appear on the record and that all presumptions against waiver of a fundamental right apply. And so this court has said before Apprendi that the waiver of the right to jury trial is like the waiver of the right to counsel in Johnson v. Zerbst, and that it should appear on the record in order to be valid. This is not really a new thing. And of course, as Justice Hobbs pointed out, this court also said that in Isaacs and Montour after Apprendi and Blakely came out, and Isaacs at least was the law at the time of the trial in this case. The trial in this case happened in 2007, February. Montour came out in 2007, so I don't know if that was out, but Robertson, also the 10th Circuit case, was out at the time of trial, and so this wasn't really a complete surprise that since 1977, the waiver of the right to jury trial is a personal right. It has to appear on the record, and it has to be knowing, intelligent, and voluntary. What do you
think the defendant has to know? You started to go through a bunch of things. I mean, do you think if the defendant could come back later on a post-conviction motion and establish that he didn't know the jury had to be unanimous, would that be an ineffective waiver?
I think so. I think that's the virtue of the rule, is it identifies the really salient points that you really do need to know to understand the distinction between a court trial and a jury trial, and to understand what you're doing. And it's not very onerous, because it's a pretty short advisement. But the salient points are, first of all, it's voluntary, and I'm not disputing that the court went over enough of that, and I'm not disputing voluntariness. But that you understand that you get a jury of 12 people, and that the prosecution has to convince all of them to agree unanimously, which makes a big difference. I mean, there is a reason why juries are not waived very often, versus I just need to convince this one trial judge. And a lot might depend on who that trial judge is and what you know about that
trial.
It's
pretty unusual. Usually it's a guilty plea or a jury trial. So that's a pretty interesting case, isn't it?
Yes. Jury trial waivers are
unusual. But even if we were to say it's substantial compliance, you're saying it didn't substantially comply.
Clearly not. I mean, the court didn't tell him any of the 5 points that you need to know in order to knowingly waive. If this were a case where, let's say, the court had left out one of those points, let's say that they have to unanimously agree, but the defense lawyer standing at the podium said, oh, judge, and I also told him that the jury would have to unanimously agree, I probably wouldn't be here right now, because then we'd have a court giving almost all the advisement and the attorney interjecting on the record and adding the piece that was missing. There was not substantial compliance in this case because the trial judge didn't give him any information at all. He only addressed voluntariness.
So if I could follow up then, how to assess the remedy, and this kind of echoes some of the comments and questions we had with your opposing counsel. Is it your position that regardless of the circumstances where there is no substantial compliance, there cannot be an effective waiver, end of story, reverse for a new trial? Or is there any way to assess the impact of that ineffective advisement, particularly in this case where we have, I believe, a comment on the record from counsel explaining basically the strategic reason for not wanting to take it to a jury trial here, given the facts alleged and so forth, that it seemed to be a very conscious and strategic decision here.
I'm going to start with that last point and then get to your first point if I remember it, and you can remind me.
Simply, how do we assess,
right?
Or is it possible to?
Your last point being that you think counsel made a statement on the record that demonstrated the reason why they were waiving a jury. And I don't really think that's right, because I think what happened is counsel did file this motion to dismiss one count on the ground of insufficient evidence. And the prosecutor said, well, maybe we should discuss your jury trial waiver first. So it was the prosecutor who raised that issue, and defense counsel said, okay, fine. So clearly they had been intending to do that. And then the waiver happened. And then after that happened, defense counsel agreed that, well, really, we need to just defer that matter until trial. This isn't something you can take up before trial. And so I don't think it's at all clear that he waived his right to jury in order to get a ruling on that motion. In fact, the court never ruled on that motion because the DA ended up dismissing that count and another count for a completely different reason at the close of evidence. So
you're saying the comment of we're choosing to not take this to trial given the nature of the facts had nothing to do with the trial as at large, or?
I don't think there was a comment about not going to a jury.
I'll see if I can find it and return to that.
I'm not aware of a comment about not going to a jury because of the nature of the facts.
Could I use that to just modify slightly to find out where you draw this line then? Let's suppose, without regard to what happened here, if you had the clearest situation in which the defendant knew all of the things he needs to know to waive a jury trial, but there was not only not complete compliance, but there wasn't even substantial compliance. Let's suppose there wasn't even a waiver. But we have an admission on the defendant's part when he makes his post-conviction motion or wherever to enforce this that he knew everything. He knew unanimous jury, knew 12, he knew everything that's in the advisement. His counsel had told him that, he understood it. Would that still not be an effective waiver of his rights simply because the rule was not substantially complied with?
Well, I have a feeling in that situation that the client would be defeating his own claim by saying, the advisement was bad, but just so you know, I knew all these things.
And there may be faults with my example of trying to come up with the clearest.
Probably that would never happen.
The point I'm trying to make is, would an adequate finding, would proof of a knowing and intelligent waiver be satisfactory without regard to substantial compliance with the rule to advise him of these things?
Yes, I think if the trial record demonstrates that it's knowing and intelligent and voluntary, even if it's like my example is, the judge left out one element from Rule 23 and the lawyer interjected it, or somebody left out one element and the DA stood up and said, oh, judge, you know, there's also this, don't forget. That's a situation where the advisement wasn't complete, but there it is right there on the record, he's been told. Then the record affirmatively establishes that he was told. And then he said, I understand and I waive anyway. I think short of that, though, that the remedy, according to this court, and now I'm going to get back to your first question, in Isaacson and Montour, is that if the record doesn't affirmatively establish that the waiver is valid, then the remedy is reversal. And I really want to talk about the federal Rule 11 cases and why they have no application here, because I didn't really even get into that in my brief. Basically, the federal Rule 11, okay, first of all, this is a whole different area of law. This is guilty pleas. The federal Rule 11 on the advisement required for guilty pleas is different from our Rule 11. It's got a few different things, one of which is this harmless error provision, which we don't have. The federal case law is different, and that's partly because the rule is different. We have our own body of cases on Rule 11, what's required. Also, our due process clause is more protective than the federal due process clause. But basically, under the federal rule, another difference is that my understanding from reading the state's cases, Dominguez, Benitez, and Bond, is that in federal court, you don't challenge your guilty plea in post-conviction. You're meant to challenge it on direct appeal. So that's a big difference. We challenge ours under 35C, and so we contemplate that there'll be an evidentiary hearing where you can put on proof, and that's not the case in federal court. So in the federal court cases where they just assess your claim on direct appeal and then don't remand it for a hearing, that's why you don't get a hearing. And in Colorado, it's established, and it has been for decades, and it was reaffirmed just recently in the Sanchez-Martinez case in 2011, which is cited in the state's brief, that once the defendant makes a prima facie case that his waiver and guilty plea wasn't knowing, intelligent, and voluntary, then the prosecution has the burden of establishing the constitutional validity of the waiver by preponderance of the evidence. That is the law in Colorado. So looking at federal cases interpreting a rule that's different from ours, and that's an entire body of case law that's different from our body of case law in this area, just doesn't make any sense, even by analogy.
Even our Rule 11 cases, though, haven't we said for a long time that Rule 11 doesn't require formalistic compliance, but rather it is designed to evidence an effective plea. And therefore, even if it's not complied with, we will look to see whether the plea was really effective.
Yes, I think there are cases that say that.
Okay, well, I'm missing the point exactly what you're doing with the federal Rule 11 ones. I mean, in a sense, the federal Rule 11 may extend an even greater right to a defendant in that by a direct appeal, he could show a violation of Rule 11 if he does it within the time to appeal and have a remedy. You're not suggesting that in the federal system he would not have a remedy for an unconstitutional guilty plea?
I think that in compelling circumstances, or there are certain circumstances where you can do a post-conviction when you have evidence outside the record. But for the most part, it's meant to be raised on direct appeal. I haven't fully researched this because I really think this is a completely collateral issue. The reason I'm talking about it is because I think the state relies heavily on these Vaughn and Dominguez-Benitez cases to make its case for plain error. And my point is, these cases have nothing to say here. They just address entirely different things, and it's dangerous business to be pulling them in when they are talking about something entirely different. I want to make a second point about Rule 11 cases and the reason why they just have no application here, and that is because guilty pleas are different, okay? And this court and the U.S. Supreme Court recognizes that. This court said in Sanchez-Martinez, the reason the defendant has to first make a prima facie showing that his waiver is invalid before the prosecution has to prove that it was is that there's a presumption of regularity and validity that attaches to a guilty plea. You're admitting you're guilty. What Dominguez-Benitez said, the U.S. Supreme Court, is that there's a particular importance of the finality of guilty pleas because they rest on a defendant's profession of guilt in open court. That's not what happened here. Mr. Walker maintained his innocence. He wanted a trial. He did not admit he was guilty. So those cases just have no application. And I think if you think about it, the extra finality that goes along with a guilty plea really makes a lot of sense, because in that case, the defendant is basically leading the DA to believe, you don't need to investigate and prepare this case for trial. I'm going to admit I'm guilty, and then maybe I'm going to come back 2 years later when everything's gone stale and you haven't investigated, and I'm going to try and get a new trial.
You know, what's lurking under here is this fear that we may go back to the Curtis litany idea, you know. that ended up in reversal of convictions so that, you know, you could go back through the litany. Now, how are you going to assure us that we're not barking down that track on this? We had to back up and blame on other cases.
You're asking about the difficulty of basically trial courts not doing what they're supposed to do?
Or doing it in such a way that you would be arguing, or we would hear from the defenders in other cases, that the litany approach to these rules applies. You're not asking us to do that, right? We're not asking for a particular formula.
I'm arguing that the record has to establish a knowing, intelligent, voluntary waiver.
And for that purpose, are you suggesting that it's simply a de novo review? We don't need to look at whether there was a contemporaneous objection made, but we simply look at it from a de novo standard? Is there not a yes? Okay.
Yeah.
My second question then is, you had mentioned earlier, okay, if the record reflects that, even if that colloquy didn't establish that the defendant understood these things, some other evidence on the record might. Perhaps defense counsel stands up and fills in a gap or something. But shy of that, we're done, automatic reversal. But would there ever be a situation where we would go back in a post-conviction context and try to establish whether, in fact, it was a knowing, voluntary, and intelligent waiver?
Well, that's not the law right now. Under Isaacs and Montour, the law is that if this waiver doesn't appear on the record, you reverse for a new trial, and I think that that's correct. And I think, I kind of feel like there's a subtext in the briefing that this court didn't know what it was doing in those cases, or, you know, just didn't get it or didn't understand, and I think that's wrong. Because in those cases, if you look at Isaacs, for example, Isaacs talked about Norman. Isaacs was aware of the Norman case, which is a case that came after Rice that did equivocate on whose burden it was and suggested it was the defendant's burden to prove he didn't waive. Well, Isaacs knew about Norman, cited Norman, and there were dissents in both of those cases. I think the court knew fully what it was doing and that those cases are correct and that they are the law. So I'm asking you to follow your own case law, which are correct. If you were going to say there needs to be more evidence, the record isn't sufficient, or something along those lines, then clearly the most you could do is what you did in Blem, which would be to say, okay, we're going to remand this for a hearing at which, because there's already a prima facie case of an invalid waiver here, that should be clear, we're going to give the prosecution the opportunity to prove that it was knowing and intelligent. I think that's the most you could do. And if you look at your Harding case, that's the case where you set out that burden and made it clear that it's the prosecution's burden to prove that the Curtis waiver was valid when the advisement was lacking.
For purposes of the burden structure you're just talking about right now, so do I understand you to say that a failure to comply with Rule 23 strictly at least makes a prima facie case that that the defendant has been deprived of his right, and therefore it's the people's burden?
Yes, I think so. Okay. Yeah, and the rule is mandatory. And the rule tells the court that it shall, you know, make these determinations on the record.
Could I go back, I think, to the questions that Justice Marquez was asking you about counsel supplementation? And I had the opportunity to find, I think, the language that she was referring to at page 58 of the transcript, where Mr. Steinberg did actually say, it seems, that there's no question that the motion attached to this case, the facts of this case, and the corroboration of the facts in this case are of a highly sensitive nature, and a lot of people, understandably, could be upset, could have their vision in terms of what the law says and what the law requires clouded. Obviously, the courts aren't in that position. He says, we waived a jury in this case for the reasons, for these reasons. I mean, isn't that something which we ought to take into account?
Which hearing was that?
I think that's at the waiver.
Is that the waiver?
He's making an opening statement.
It's right after what I think it's Judge Tidball to page 58.
Okay. Yeah, no, I think it sounds, from what you're saying, it sounds like he's making a statement of why it's happening. But the problem here isn't voluntariness. And the problem is also...
Well, I'm not actually questioning it with respect to voluntariness. I'm actually trying to just amplify Justice Marquez's question, which is, shouldn't we take this into account as to why he was making this decision to waive his jury and whether or not it was an appropriate waiver?
Sure. I think you can take the whole record of the colloquy into account. I just don't think the fact that the attorney offered a reason means that it was knowing and that Mr. Walker understood that it was his personal decision, perhaps even if his attorney didn't want to go to a jury, and that he understood all these distinctions. And I just want to make one final point about the whole Rule 11 area of law and the Curtis area of law versus this area of law, and that is there's a phrase that courts like to use, practical realities, which I think means we just can't reverse this many cases. And in the Rule 11 context, that was a big problem, and that's a big reason for the federal law being what it is, because of the thousands and thousands of guilty pleas that are entered every year. And in the Curtis area, I think in Blem, this court basically said this isn't working out as well as we had hoped. The courts aren't doing their job, too many reversals. The waiver of jury trial, as we discussed, is pretty unusual. It doesn't happen very often. This isn't that kind of a problem. This isn't a high volume problem. Courts ought to be able to make this advisement just like they're expected to make the advisement for a waiver of counsel. I think it's much more akin to that situation. It's rare that somebody waives counsel or jury trial. And in both situations, we say, let's stop and let's give this full advisement. And if it's not on the record, then we're just going to reverse it. Moving on to the other issues, if you don't reverse everything because of the jury trial waiver, you still must remand the case for determinate sentences on the exploitation counts because the sentence enhancer wasn't charged, and Mr. Walker didn't waive his right to a jury trial on that.
Are you saying that the sentence enhancer had to be charged, or does that just go to the question of knowledge and waiver on the part of them?
I think it absolutely had to be charged.
Okay, like a crime of violence or something?
Yes.
Is that in the statute?
No, it's not in the statute. Well, in fact, the statute's been repealed, as you know. So it doesn't even exist anymore.
As applicable here.
Yeah, it wasn't in the statute. And of course the statute was repealed because it violates Blakely, and that was a consensus decision stated on the legislative record. So I don't feel like there's a whole lot to say about this, but on the charging issue.
Since you brought in Blakely on that, I guess where I really am curious about this, let's assume for purposes of my next question that I might find, or we might find, it's not required to be charged. In terms of the waiver and Blakely, I guess what I'm curious about is, we have said before, even in Isaacs and I think some of the cases you've mentioned, Montour, that accession to judge fact-finding, to judicial fact-finding, would get you outside the Blakely problem. If we were to find there was a valid waiver of a jury trial, do you feel that there would be an additional advisement that would have to have taken place with regard to a sentencing factor, or that accession to judicial fact-finding for purposes of the whole trial would also include any sentencing factors?
Well, I mean, this is precisely why it needs to be charged, because if it had been charged, then at the time he was called upon to waive his right to jury, he would have known it existed. And if the court had given the CRIMP 23 advisement, the court would have told him, you, by the way, you're waiving your right to jury trial on all facts they have to prove, including the sentencing facts. So this makes my point of why it has to be charged, because you need to know what you're waiving. So absolutely, let's say it was a scenario where it was an enhancer that could be added later. Like, say, habitual criminal that the DA didn't know about, I think the statute says if you find out about it later, you can add it later. I don't think that applies here, because I think here you need to know going in, for all the reasons I talked about in my briefs, when you're making decisions and hiring a lawyer and investigating the case, if this is going to be an indeterminate sentence, this is an entirely different situation. But even if it were one of these statutes where, okay, DA found about your priors later, he can add the count later, then yeah, you would, and if you had a jury trial right as to that, then yeah, you would have to have a separate waiver, because Blakely and Montour and Isaacs and Lopez all make it clear that you have a separate jury trial right as to sentencing facts, and your waiver has to either cover that or you've got to have a separate waiver.
And so just to finish the last sentence on that, so is you are in effect arguing that by failing to have him adequately waive his right to judicial fact-finding with regard to the sentencing factor, that actually goes to his failure to waive a jury trial at all. That is, you're saying he had to be advised of the sentencing factor in order to make an effective waiver of his right to a jury trial.
Yes.
Okay.
And in particularly in a case where then that comes into play. And I want to make it clear that I am relying on the state and federal due process right to notice and the Sixth Amendment right to notice and the right to notice in Article Section 2, Article 16 of the Colorado Constitution. All of those are the grounds for this claim that you must charge. Apprendi didn't rule on charging, but it did make some comments on it, and Apprendi said any fact other than a prior conviction that increases the maximum penalty must be charged in the indictment. Pursuant to the Fifth Amendment and the Sixth Amendment notice guarantee. That's right in Apprendi. Now, that's not part of the holding, but that is what they said. Apprendi also said that they were discussing three areas of safeguards, the safeguards going to the formality of notice, the identity of the fact finder, and the burden of proof. In the Lopez case, this court ruled that a defendant is entitled to notice of the sentence enhancer. And you rejected this argument, and this is the first Lopez case. You rejected this argument that the mere fact that there are sentencing provisions in the statute books on somebody's shelf in an office doesn't mean that a person has notice that they could be facing those sentence enhancers that haven't been charged in the information. Clearly, the right to notice means that the prosecution has to tell you what charges you're facing and what the potential penalties may be when you're making all of your decisions about how to proceed, what pleas might appear advantageous, how much to investigate. That's necessary information under due process and the notice provision. I'm not going to go over the evidence that Mr. Walker didn't know that this existed. Unless the court has questions about that, I think the record in this case uniquely makes it very clear that Mr. Walker really had no idea that this statute existed, and his attorney had no idea, and the DA either didn't know it existed or didn't intend to pursue it based on the DA's comments after the verdict. So this is really a notice case. There's no formality here whatsoever. And even if plain error review applied to the charging claim, it clearly would be satisfied. If you look at the Cotton case, which was a Fifth Amendment grand jury indictment rationale, which is a little bit different, but they said it was error not to charge it, but it was harmless because the evidence was overwhelming, that it wasn't disputed. In this case, Mr. Walker vigorously disputed the proof of the sentence enhancer, and in my book, they didn't ever prove it. I know you didn't take cert on that issue, but it's very relevant to the harmlessness. It clearly was not harmless that Mr. Walker had no awareness of the fact that his sentences could balloon from a determinate sentence to an indeterminate sentence based on the findings in a probation report. I see my time is just about up, so I will ask you to reverse Mr. Walker's convictions. Thank you.
Thank you. Rebuttal? Mr. Michaels?
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Just very quickly, I want to touch on a few things of the jury trial waiver before I talk about the indeterminate sentencing issue. Penalty ranges aren't required to be discussed for a jury trial waiver. There's nothing in the statute that says that, or in the rule that says that. And several courts, including People versus Bannister out of the Supreme Court of Illinois, have explicitly said that sentencing is just not a consequence of waiving a jury trial. And the reason is that the sentencing range is the same, no matter who the fact finder is. Quoting from them, the pivotal knowledge that the defendant must understand is that the facts of the case will be determined by a judge and not a jury. That's the pivotal question for a jury trial waiver, and they cite several other cases, both state and federal cases, in support of that
proposition. Could I ask you just one question about that? I appreciate you pointing that out, and that was something that I was concerned about, but now take the step further that we've got here. Would that finding by those courts apply to a situation in which some additional fact had to be found to get an enhanced sentence?
I think that would be something that would have to be discussed during a waiver. But a factual waiver, Blakely only requires one waiver for a jury in order to get, for all factual circumstances, in order to get to an enhanced sentence. So as soon as you have that one factual waiver, that's all that's required. To the extent that opposing counsel discusses Isaacs and Montour, those are very fact-specific cases, Montour particularly. Montour, there was a statute here in Colorado that specifically and explicitly required a second jury waiver in order to proceed to the death penalty phase. This court reversed because that was not complied with and struck the language that was otherwise and said you have to go back for a resentencing on that issue. So that's a very narrow, stuck-in-a-box case that doesn't apply here. Isaacs is similarly unique to itself and not applicable here because Isaacs dealt with a jury or a plea bargain where there was no established factual basis and the defendant waived his factual basis and in fact pled guilty to a crime that was not originally charged and there was no factual basis for. So the court then turned around and used the facts of the charged crime to which the defendant did not plead guilty and use those to aggravate the sentence. And that's where the problem was. It wasn't about, there was no waiver of enhanced sentence. There was simply no waiver. The crime to which that defendant, Isaacs, pled guilty was a very different crime than the ones that he was charged with and that there was a factual basis for. I do want to talk about the remedy because I know that's something that, especially Justice Marquez, you were interested in. And the remedy is a remand. Blem is very explicit about this, remand to determine if the defendant, quote, minimally understood the waiver requirements. And opposing counsel mentioned the 1977 case from this course, Rice versus People. And that also confirms that a remand is at best the remedy. And Rice said that where the record reflects a personal expression of the defendant's desire to waive, then generally even a remand won't be necessary because it'll be upheld. In Rice, there was absolutely no statement from the defendant whatsoever. It was just the defense counsel got up and said, my client wants to waive his jury trial, right? Done. And this court correctly said, well, you need to hear from the defendant. Rice, I think, is interesting in that respect because we have that here. We have the defendant saying repeatedly, I want to do it. I'm not being coerced. I want to waive my jury trial, right? We have that in Rice. Rice explicitly says that's enough. We don't even need to do the costly and time-consuming process of a remand when we have a personal affirmation from the defendant. And Peel versus Norman confirms that. No on-record colloquy is required so long as there is a personal expression from the defendant. At a remand, we would presume the regularity of it would be the defendant's burden to overcome the regularity of the proceeding, and the defendant must prove that the actual waiver was invalid, and that had he had a proper advisement, he would have gone to a jury trial instead of going to a trial to the court. The federal case law is very clear and unanimous that there's no reversible error where the only claim is noncompliance. I do want to talk about the indeterminate range sentencing because I think that's very important. And we disagree on the very fundamental aspect of this, and that's that the indeterminate range sentence here is not an enhanced range. It is the legislatively mandated range in the presumptive range. If you look at the presumptive range for the determinate sentence and the indeterminate sentence, no sentence, not any of the 30-plus sentences that this defendant received were in an aggravated range. The exploitation count was properly charged, and exploitation, unlike, say, sexual assault, pattern of abuse, or assault with a deadly weapon, or assault inflicting first-degree serious bodily injury, those are all sentence enhancers. Exploitation doesn't carry that. It simply gives you the definition of exploitation.
I may misunderstand this a little. Maybe you could sort of explain to us. What's the nature of the indeterminate sentence that must be given if those findings are
sure? Let me back up a little bit, and hopefully I'll get to your question with a better understanding. Exploitation is one of several unique sex-based crimes where the trial court has discretion to either do a determinate sentence or an indeterminate sentence. But that basis comes directly from a sex offense evaluator's assessment. I know this court heard five arguments on the sexually violent predator and all that. I'm not going to whip a dead horse. So I'll let you rest on that knowledge. But with sex-based offenses, everybody has to look, the defendant, the trial court, the prosecutor, everybody looks to 18.1.3.1003. That defines sex offense and defines what offenses are mandatory. But in 1003 sub 4, it specifically says, in addition to these listed offenses, sexual assault on a child, first-degree sexual assault, those sort of things, in addition to those offenses, you have to look at 1004 sub 4, which is what that issue here. And 1004 sub 4 defines economic sex crimes, which says if this crime occurs and if an assessment determines that the defendant is likely to reoffend, and it lists the specific statutes where you're going to look at what offenses, then the court has discretion. But it's not basing that on any specific jury findings. It's not requiring a sentence-enhancing element in order to say you get an indeterminate sentence. In fact, the legislature very easily could have just said from the get-go, all sexual exploitation is an indeterminate sentence.
And maybe my question is really, really fundamental.
Okay.
And that is, so what's the indeterminate sentence that's required? What's the lower end and upper end?
The lower end would be, the upper end would be up to a maximum of life in prison consistent with the sex offense.
And is that not a longer sentence than if you were not sentenced under the Lifetime Sex Offender Act?
It's a longer sentence than a determinate range sentence, but it's also the sentence that is legislatively mandated, and that's what Apprendi and Blakely had a problem with, something that was beyond what was legislatively mandated.
It's only legislatively mandated if there's some fact determined which is beyond what the jury decides, is it not?
But the fact here is different than a jury-determined fact. In cases where you have sentence enhancers like a pattern of abuse or a weapon or a significant injury, here we have to have a sexually violent predator assessment. And it's not a full assessment. You're just looking for the future risk assessment. And that's something that this court has consistently held is something that's outside the ambit of the jury because it's an assessment about the defendant's character. And either way, that defendant is going to be receiving that sexual evaluation. So,
and do I understand you then that sort of a bottom line on this, that you're saying to enhance a sentence beyond on the basis of a fact not decided by the jury is not a violation of Blakely Apprendi as long as it's done by this commission or by the assessor then?
In this case, yes. And it's a very limited class of cases. Again, it's been repealed this year, although I, for the life of me, don't know where in the legislature opposing counsel talked about it being unconstitutional. All I could see from what I heard of the legislative history is that it was just kind of confusing and that there was a lot of disagreement about it. So the process essentially is a defendant gets convicted. Immediately upon conviction, the trial court orders a pre-sentence investigation, a sexual offense evaluation. The evaluation is then presented to the court, at which point the court has that fork in the road moment saying, this evaluator said he's likely to reoffend. That's consistent with the Lifetime Supervision Act's goals of treating a sex offender. And that's part of the reason that we have this evaluation is sex offenders require a lot more treatment, a lot more attention, a lot more care, sometimes up to life life treatment. And that's laid out in the goals and definitions of the Lifetime Supervision Act. And so consistent with that, the evaluator says, based on this crime, this guy needs significantly more treatment, significantly more attention. So the court has to make that determination. It's like a fork in the road. On one side, you have a presumptive determinate sentence. On the other side, you have a presumptive indeterminate sentence. But the presumptive indeterminate sentence and the presumptive determinate sentence both allow for aggravating the sentence beyond the statutory maximum. That didn't happen here. And the fact that both allow for that statutory aggravation just underscores the fact that this is nothing more than the presumptive range sentence.
Can I actually follow up on that just very quickly? So you're saying, sure, basically we don't have an Apprendi or Blakely problem here because all of these types of crimes, including sexual exploitation, can be indeterminate sentences, and that is statutorily authorized.
Right.
And you're also saying that what gets me in that door into the indeterminate sentencing for purposes of sexual exploitation, which ordinarily wouldn't be in there, is this SVP assessment.
Just the future risk determination.
The future risk determination portion of that assessment. But is it not true? It's the trial court actually has to reach some conclusion, does it not? Or are you saying that trial court really has no discretion if the assessment itself reaches that conclusion?
I think the trial court always has to have that discretion to make the ultimate decision, consistent with the SVP cases that you had.
And that's not an additional finding beyond
because it's not an element of the crime of exploitation itself. It's not an enhanced element that increases the punishment based on a defendant's actions. It's based on the evaluation and based on the risk and based on the fact that exploitation is specifically included in the indeterminate sentencing scheme 18.1.3, 1003, and 1004 as an indeterminate sentence level crime. The other question is that, did that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay. Just very quickly, functionally, this just wouldn't work because essentially you would have to have a jury, then you'd have to break for who knows how many weeks or months, get a PSR, an evaluation, and then have that jury come back or have another jury come back, at which point we'll be having the jury look at that PSR and evaluation. My time is up. I would ask that this court hold that substantial compliance with CRIMP 23852 is sufficient to establish a valid waiver, and if that's not the case, then to have post-conviction remedy. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Michaels.